The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Been off for a couple weeks. Glad to be back. And my next guest, the CEO and co-founder of The Vines, Michael Evans, is joining me. Michael, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So I want to talk about The Vines, you getting into wine, what it means to help create accidental winemakers. I want to start here because whenever I talk to winemakers about some of the difficulties it comes to making wine, everyone gives different answers. But doing some research, you had one that that really stood out to me. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what it's like fighting giant armies of ants when trying to make wine, a quote to stave off a plague of ants.
Well, actually, in Mendoza, we're very fortunate because it's a high desert and it's very dry, so we don't have the problems with mildew and rot and a lot of things that other parts of the world have. And are really the only pest we have to deal with is ants. And when we first got started, the first couple of years in, you know, there's obviously a lot of disruption to the land when we planted. We now have 1,000 acres planted, and that caused a lot of disruption. And there were apparently lots of millions and millions of ants that decided that they were gonna try and halt our progress. And we did figure out how to deal with them. We found some organic products to deal with them. We actually at one point even considered getting a small group of anteaters to come and try and solve the problem for us, but it was hard to get to import them into Argentina, so we had to scratch that idea.
Hold on a second. And I know I'm going about this interview wrong. I should do the intro before we get here, but you guys actually thought that is hilarious. So it's very difficult to suddenly transport anteaters to Mendoza?
Yeah, it's really difficult to import livestock that are not that are not native to the property. So my you can imagine my agronomist calling up the customs department in Argentina saying, "Hey, I want to import some anteaters to Argentina." We didn't get very far.
At the very least, the person who took that call, that must have been a new one for them. When they got home that day, you know, that was a new one. So let's start with explaining to people. I love this. An explorers club and worldwide community dedicated to winemaking. I was wondering, now we'll start at the beginning, founded back in 2005 in Mendoza, Argentina. Just what is The Vines all about?
Well, we started, I've been a wine lover for most of my adult life and some of my prior to being a young life, let's say, growing up with my being around always on the family table. And when I went to Argentina for what I thought was going to be a 3-week vacation in 2004, I just fell in love with the place. I mean, Mendoza is spectacularly beautiful. The wines are phenomenal. The people are great. And it just seemed like a place that was going to grow and become important in the world of wine. I had traveled extensively throughout Europe and through the States, and I saw the quality of the wines was there, but the quality of the tourist experience, the quality of the visit experience was not there. So I knew that it was something, it was interesting going to happen. And so we just started thinking around how I could achieve my dream of owning a vineyard and making wine. And so I started looking around and I found a small piece of land that I was going to buy 10 acres and go back to the States and come back. And my business partner, Pablo Jimenez, whose family's been making wine for generations, he was going to manage it for me. And as soon as I started talking to my friends, I said, well, if you're going to do that, I need to do it as well. And so all of a sudden we had 10 guys that each wanted to have their own small vineyard. And the light bulb went off and said, you know, a lot of people have this dream of owning a vineyard and making wines, but perhaps don't have the resources or the time to make it in any part of the world where it would cost millions of dollars, not tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars to do as it in Mendoza. So that's where it all started. And that was in 2004. Today we've got 254 different owners that each own a small vineyard anywhere between 1 and 20 acres in Mendoza, where we manage it for them and then make wines for them each year. And so that was going along well. We opened a 5-star hotel 7 years ago, so people have a place to stay when they visit. And as a wine lover, me, like a lot of people, I'm always looking for what's the next wine. I've got my favorites and I've got the ones that I always go back to, but I always want to find something that's unique, that's a little different. And so we have been searching for a way to expand this concept into other regions, to be able to make wines that in other parts of the world and different wines. And so that's where we came across this this idea, this concept of partnering with great winemakers around the world. And today we've got 8 sites around the world where we make wine.
Yeah, and some famous ones. I see Dr. Lotion in Moselle. You're in Priorat, Napa Valley, you know, Montalcino. So for people, like the joke is, if you want to make $1 million in wine, you're going to have to invest $2 million. You know, because there's so much overhead and capital early on. So what is it that you guys do? Because it's a great concept, because so many people have the dream of, I'd love to make my own wine, but I mean, the capital required to get that started is going to be daunting and is going to certainly make it difficult for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And at the same time, there are wineries around the world, fabulous winemakers, who are always looking to share their wines. Even the best wineries in the world, with the exception of 2 or 3, still need to sell their wines. And they're looking for interesting ways. And they're looking for people that are passionate about their wines. So to be able to go into the Mosel and custom blend a wine with Ernie Lotion, and then end up with your own wine that's unique in the world, is really fabulous. And the people that do it, they don't need to invest in buying vineyards, in buying tanks, in winemakers and all of that, because all of the infrastructure is already there with our partners. They're already making these things, and our winemakers are happy to meet people that are so passionate about their wines that they want to learn more, in fact, to the extent that they want to make their own blends and have their own bottles.
It's such a cool concept. And I think part of the reason I mentioned that one is I'm hoping this fall, it just depends on COVID and regulations and all that, I want to travel to Germany. Like it's my next on my bucket list is to do Germany and then go to Austria and try to do Austria afterwards. I do like 2 weeks traveling around. That's the next on my bucket list.
You're on the right track. I was just there 2 weeks ago, meeting with Ernie and some other folks, and we tasted some phenomenal wines. And the fascinating thing about most Rieslings, we went to 5 or 6 different wineries, and at most of them, the most expensive wine that they had was $25 or $30. They're mm-hmm. very good wines. They're kind of super premium wines, $15, $18. I mean, Riesling has such a bad reputation, and the prices have fallen so much that the value you can get for those wines is just phenomenal.
It's crazy. And we are going to get back to Mendoza, but like that price is crazy when you consider how difficult it is to get those grapes, the crazy, you know, the super, just the angles that the hills are there. It's dangerous to, it's not like you just got one tractor and you're going across some flat land in Napa. This is difficult area to make wine.
Now, the people that do it there, you know, it's really amazing. I mean, they literally are strapped in as if they're rock climbing when they're pruning or when they're harvesting. And in fact, that kind of experience and understanding different regions is one of the big things that we do. Although the kind of one of the cores is actually going and blending the wine, making your own wine with Ernie or Giacomo in Montalcino or Tony and Jeff in Napa. But it is getting to know these places. So many of our members have not spent a lot of time in Germany drinking Riesling. They haven't spent a lot of time drinking Riesling because they had one 10 years ago and their palate, it was terrible. So they gave up on it. So not only do we go in there, so typically we have these blending escapes where we'll take our members for 3 or 4 days into a place like Mosel. We'll be going in mid-October to the Mosel with Ernie, and we'll spend a couple days. We start out with an orientation tasting. Here's 5 or 6 wines that are typical of the Rieslings from this region. So people can get a sense. This is the ones that are bone dry. These are the ones that are super sweet. And these are the things that are in between. We'll explain to them about these crazy slopes, as you suggest, where people do the farming. We'll take them around to 2 or 3 different wineries. We'll have phenomenal meals at the local restaurants. And we'll spend a day with Ernie and his team in the winery actually blending those wines, which then each of our members will create their own label and their own packaging. So in six, eight months, when the wines are finally finished and bottled, they'll show up at their house with their own custom bottles, and they'll have that weekend. So they'll have the context. It's not just about the wine, but so much of the wine is the terroir, and not just the literal terroir of the dirt and the sun and the water and the environment, but the people and the restaurants and the culture and all of that. And so that's what we try and do during these blending escapes, is getting people to understand and enjoy and live what it is like to be a winemaker, an accidental winemaker, if you will, for a couple of days.
That is so cool. And I'm, of course, wildly biased. The idea of hanging out with Ernie and blending and making Riesling just sounds about... it'd be hard for me to think of a better way to spend my time or my money. How difficult is it right now, just with your venture, with COVID, and just how much harder it is to travel, and you got to jump through a lot of hoops just to get from one country to another?
Well, you know, the challenge is the uncertainty that you have, that you know, people that travel, they worry that they're not going to be able to get to the next destination. Mm-hmm. I think. Once you're vaccinated, it is fairly easy to travel between the U.S. And Europe right now. I'm in Spain at the moment. I was in Germany and France last week. I'll go to Italy in a couple weeks. So it's fairly easy, assuming that you're vaccinated. You just have to file a lot of paperwork.
Yeah. No. Okay. That's good. That's good to know. I did the same thing. I was from Canada, traveled to Vegas. I got my second vaccine ages ago. And yeah, you got to download an app. You're going to have to put some work in, but you're right. You can do it. I read this quote about Mendoza, and you said it was way more approachable than the other wine regions. I'd love to hear more just your thoughts about Mendoza when you first arrived and decided to set roots there and today. Because, yeah, I imagine certainly it'd be less expensive than if you tried to do what you're doing in Champagne. But, yeah, I'm just curious about what your impressions of Mendoza.
Well, Mendoza's certainly grown a lot in the last 15, 16 years since we've been there. When I got there, it felt like Napa, you know, not 10 or 20 years ago, but 50 years ago or 75 years ago. But even today, there are world-class restaurants and world-class hotels and wineries that are making some of wines that I think are right up there in terms of quality with anywhere in the world. However, it's still very local. They're still farmers at the end of the day. They're farmers, they're winemakers. You know, you go to Napa or you go to Bordeaux and you're very rarely, unless you're very well connected, you're very rarely going to meet the winemaker or spend time with the owner or the farmer that's actually the agronomist that's doing it. And so in Mendoza, 9 times out of 10, except at the very biggest wineries, and oftentimes even at those, the person you're going to meet when you go to taste is the winemaker, is the agronomist, is people that are actually involved in the production, not just somebody that is there to give you a wonderful tourist experience. So it's a bit more intimate still even today.
And you said that wine was always a part of your life. So let's go back a little bit. Did you have that aha moment, that bottle of wine that you realized, oh, I got to, you know, this is more than just something I enjoy with food? Or was it just something that just came over time?
I think for me, it's the combination of, for a bottle of wine, and it's interesting because now that I've been making wine for 15 years or so, I have a lot of the same bottles of wine. So I've had 50 of one specific bottle. And the truth is, even though that's the same exact wine, I have 50 different memories, 50 different experiences every time I drink it. So for me, it's not just the wine, it's all the things that come with it. It is, you know, in Portugal, drinking a crisp white wine while sitting on the beach, eating some of the best shellfish in the world, that to me is that Portuguese wine. Or in Barcelona, having tapas, having some clams and drinking a ice cold, super crisp Albarino, or in Tuscany having a beef ragu or the boar ragu with pasta and a bottle of Brunello. So it's that combination of the culture and the terroir and the wine that all mixes together that really makes it happen for me.
It's so true. The quality of wine is often about the quality of the experience and about everything going on around it. Hey, so now you've been making wine now. I'm curious, how different are you as a winemaker today versus when you got started in the early to mid 2000s?
Well, that's a great question. You know, winemaking and wine tasting is like anything else. It's reps, it's practice. And in winemaking, the biggest difference is understanding that the wine that you blend today is going to be very different when you drink it, especially if you're making something like a Brunello that you might not even drink. It's not even going to be ready to bottle for 3 or 4 years, and you might not drink it for 5 or 10 years. And so thinking about how this wine that's tasting today is going to taste in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. And so the experience of doing that over and over again and working with such great professionals. I mean, the biggest advantage that I have is that I learn something from Ernie in the Mosel and Giacomo in Montalcino and Michelle in Champagne and Tony in Napa and Pablo in Mendoza. So, you know, all of the, I do blending sessions with all of these people. And so I learned from them, and that's kind of accelerated my learning. But the biggest thing for me and for our members, I think, is being able to project where the wine is going to go.
Right.
And what happens is the first time somebody makes a wine with us, they're a little nervous. They may not feel that confident about what they want to do or how it's going to end up. So they leave a lot of it kind of in our hands. And it's like, okay, well, you know what? I really like big, intense wine. So help me make a Napa Cab that's a big, intense type of thing. Or I like things that are a little more elegant and fresh. And then over time, in a relatively short amount of time, over a couple years, you see them start making more and more decisions. And so they might, and where initially they're like, make me a big Napa style cab type thing, to, you know what? I think that we need to let this hang a little longer before harvest so that we can get the bricks up a little higher, get slightly more alcohol. And then to offset that, let's do a extended maceration for 5 to 6 days so we can get a little more intensity, and then needs to go in a big old medium toast barrel. So they're making more and more of the decisions over the time. And that's where the fun comes in. You know, it's one thing if you can order up a catering to your house if you're having people over for your dinner, and it's fun. You're going to have a great meal. But if you went that morning to the farmer's market and you picked out what you're going to cook and you spent the day cooking and preparing and getting ready for your guests, it's a much more rich experience. And that's how we look at the winemaking with the vines.
And what a great idea, you know, for people that want to do it, but maybe a little nervous, because I can understand the insecurity of it, because there's so many factors that can ruin a wine. At the very least, your members have access to all these experts who have been doing it, probably in their family, for some of them for hundreds and hundreds of years. So at least you have that safety net of someone that can hold your hand on those critical moments, especially early on.
That's a great way to describe it. If you've been to a carnival or an amusement with little kids lately, then, you know, they've got these car tracks, and the little kids, they can steer, but there's a rail that goes down the middle, so you can't drive off the track. So they feel like they steer, but they can't actually wreck the car. And that's kind of how we are. Like some people, you know, and you're doing a blending and maybe you tasted a lot of the base wines and you're getting a little too creative. You know, we'll come in and say, you know, you can make whatever you want, of course, but this is the implications. This wine that you taste today that tastes fabulous, maybe, you know, doesn't have the backbone of acidity or the backbone of structure that's going to evolve into the wine you're probably looking for.
I remember asking this of winemakers, especially when they retire. But for you, what is your relationship with the Weather Network versus before you got into wine and just checking to see what the weather is now versus say 2003?
Well, there's a couple of things that play into that, right? I mean, part of it is as a winemaker, and especially it was a little easier when I was only making wine in Mendoza because I was living there, and you know, of course we'd look at the weather because we were there and we want to see what's going on, and we'd communicate that with our owners or around the world. But now that we're making wine all over, it's a little more challenging, but it's also much more important. Just in the last 18 months, we've had tough frosts in Mendoza. We've had smoke that has basically destroyed almost the entire 2020 vintage on the west coast of the States last year. There is a early frost this year in Champagne. So there are, you know, and one of the things that we like about the way we're making wine now is that there's flexibility. So that, you know what, 2020 from Napa is not going to be a good vintage, but 2020 from Mendoza was fabulous, and 2020 from Italy is looking pretty darn good. So you've got some optionality about where you make wine and where you want to, you know, which wines you might want to drink a little earlier than or a little later.
Yeah, for people that are just dipping their toe into Argentinian wine, what would you recommend? What should they expect?
I think that, like in almost any region, you want to get out of the, there's a sweet spot in the middle. So you know, I wouldn't, there are certainly some really good Argentine wines that are 8, 10, 12 bucks. But when you're just getting started, you know, if you get up there closer to 18, 20, 22, in that range, you can get some really, really nice wines that are going to compare favorably to any region in the world. If you want to step up a little bit and you want to have a $40 or $50 bottle of wine, 9 times out of 10, especially in the reds, that Argentine red for $40 or $50 is going to blow the water out of any other wine from any region of the world. Mm-hmm. And so that you've got, so especially in the structure, they're big wines generally. They're higher in alcohol, though you can find some other ones. But if you like big wines, Argentina, you're going to be able to find things at any price point. And then I would also look towards some of the new varietals. Of course, Malbec is king of Argentina, but the Cab Franc is unbelievable, especially from the Uco Valley and the higher end, the higher elevations. And they're really coming up with some nice Rhone blends. There's some GSMs that are phenomenal.
Yeah, and I guess with the Franc ones, that would be more sourced, as you said, higher altitude, because it's not like that grape doesn't need as much heat as say Malbec.
Well, it doesn't need the heat, but you also want some heat to, well, depending on the style. And if you really like a French style Cabernet Franc that is very kind of green peppery and has that herbaceous quality, then you've got some flexibility. But I prefer the ones that are a bit less herbaceous, less green.
Yes.
And so in Mendoza and the Uco Valley, we don't have that. You've got a little Piracina like you do in a Cabernet Sauvignon, but it doesn't have that that same level of greenness that some people, that fanatics of Cabernet Franc from Bordeaux love, but for me, I like them a little more pure.
I want if there's green pepper, I just want a tiny bit of it in the background. But
exactly,
I'm the same way. What because you have an interesting background, what were you doing before your trip to Argentina?
Well, I used to work in politics, which may have led to my drinking. Actually, if I was in politics still, then I'm sure I would be drinking a lot more. I used to work on presidential campaigns. So I worked for President Clinton in 92 and 96 and Gore in 2000 and of course Kerry in 2004 and ended my traded in my political campaign work for winemaking, which is a lot more fun.
So. And I say this as someone who has voted left and right in Canada. I have voted for our Liberal candidates. Hell, I once voted for the NDP, and I have voted Conservative. So I'm someone who always goes in with complete intellectual flexibility. But this is a wine question. I'm curious. What was the best bottle of wine you ever opened for, say, Clinton? And what was a wine you opened to get you through what happened with Kerry?
Well, Clinton actually is not I don't think he drinks at all anymore, and he wasn't a big drinker back in the day either. And so I didn't share bottles with President Clinton. But over the Kerry thing, actually it wasn't wine, but I did get. We did have a lot to drink that first night. I mean, as you recall, in 2004,
yes,
it looked like that Kerry was going to win. All of our internal numbers said he was going to win. The exit polling, it looked clear that he was. And over the preceding 12, 14 hours after that, it became clear that that he didn't. So so we had a we did drown our sorrows that evening for sure.
As one should, because the amount of hours it takes to work and you put in a campaign like that, that's 7 days a week, that's 16 hours a day. I imagine there might have been a nice bottle after the last U.S. election.
There were definitely a nice bottle of champagne after the election. We had to wait a few days, actually.
Yes.
But there was definitely champagne that was being popped. But I don't know. I think that... now that I'm out of it, the whole system is messed up on both sides. I certainly lean left, but there's plenty of blame to throw around, and the biggest problem is that there's not conversation. The right and the left they don't talk anymore. They listen to different news. They live in different parts of a state or the country or the world. There's just two different realities. They listen to different music. They watch different movies. They read different books. I mean, it's just, and there's no conversation. And when I grew up in Washington, D.C., and being so close to politics, you know, during the day, the right extremes on the right and left, whether it was, you know, Strom Thurmond, staunch Republican, and Moynihan or Tip O'Neill on the left side, they would, you know, give each other hell on the Senate floor. But at the end of the day, they'd go into the Monocle, sit down and have a bourbon and work something out and say, you know what? I think that on both sides, they did want to get something that would be good for the people. And today people just want to win. They want to make the other guy look bad and they don't seem very interested in doing things for the good of people. So I'm hopeful that something good will come back and we can get back to some political dialogue.
Yeah, everyone talks about bipartisan until it's time to actually be bipartisan. Last political thing we're going here. Is there, between left-wing and between Democrats and Republicans, is there a wine leaning? Is there a generalization that if you're Democratic, you might drink more this, or you're Republican, you might drink more that, or does it just, it's just individual?
I don't think so. I haven't really noticed those trends.
Okay, that's good. I had this image in my head of someone who is very right wing. It's like, I'm not going to drink the French stuff. I'm going to.
There could be some, who knows. Yeah.
What's the big bold thing going on in Texas? How different is Mendoza now in terms of the perception versus when you started? And I haven't really talked to a lot of people on this podcast about Argentinian wines or things like that. So I'm grateful to have you on, Michael. Just some of the differences now versus when you got started.
I think that Argentina was, quote, the hot new thing 15, 16, 20 years ago. So it's no longer the hot new thing. But in some ways that's very good because it is, I think it's certainly and rightfully seen as among the best regions in the world, and should be mentioned in the same time as California and the other New World regions, and also comparable to many of the wines that are coming out of Europe and the Old World wines. So I think that has really established. Right, one of the things that's happening now is that since it was all about Malbec for so long, and there's now this new generation of winemakers that have been coming up over the last, say, 10 years. And they're experimenting. They're doing crazy stuff. Some of it's terrible. Some of it's phenomenal. And so that experimentation, that willingness to try to plant different varietals, play with different blends, do different things, it's very similar to what I saw in Paso Robles when I was there a couple months ago. It's just that experimentation and driving for something new and different, I think, is really exciting and will drive this next phase of Mendoza.
It's interesting. It's almost like what's going on in Mendoza was similar to Australia, where Australia got famous because of their Shiraz. But then all the winemakers like, no, we are much more than just the big fruit bomb Shiraz you get at the grocery store. Same thing in Ontario. Ontario makes great Cab Franc, incredible Pinot and Chardonnay. But people think Canada, their first thought is, oh, this must be, it's ice wine country. And it's something that a lot of regions have to deal with, is breaking away from a wine that on some levels put them on the map. But now it's like, no, we're much more than just that.
Yeah, I think that's true. And that's been true in a lot of regions and is important because people need to realize, should realize that there's a great opportunity. And it goes back to the value question. So Malbecs tend to be a little priced higher, but some of the red blends are fantastic. The GSMs are, even some Pinot Noirs are starting to come out of Argentina and a really good value these days.
Before let's go, tell me a little bit about this before we end on just where people can find an info from the vines. I'd love to hear more about the resort. I know basically Germany and Austria is next. Then after that, it's either South Africa or it's going to be coming to Argentina and Chile.
Well, come down and visit. So we opened a luxury resort 7 years ago now. It's called the Vines Resort and Spa. It's really built around this idea of getting to know Argentina, getting to know Mendoza. I went there on vacation. I was supposed to be there 3 weeks and I fell in love with the place. And so rather than take you to the places that are in all the guidebooks, we want to give you a real local experience. So we're going to suggest that you get on a horse and you go up into the Andes. We're going to get you in the vineyard and you can, depending on what time of year, you can pick some grapes, you can do some pruning. We'll get you in the winery so you can actually do some sorting if it's during a harvest. You know, it's a really interactive type of way. The resort is also built around our chef, Francis Malman, who is a really phenomenal and famous chef who cooks over live fire. Our restaurant's called Siete Fuegos, Seven Fires, which is a really extraordinary experience, especially if you like to cook. We've got cooking classes and the food is really, really quite good. 22 villas. We've got a great pool. It's nice, warm and dry in the Mendoza desert.
By the way, if I come down, I'm much better on the blending side, the blending tasting side, than the pruning side. These these hands here, pruning, not an easy job. Again, these wines are remarkably inexpensive considering all all that is required to make the wine. And I guess in the end, like, this is one of the most unique wine clubs. I've interviewed a lot of people that own wine clubs, but the vines, what you're doing is certainly unique. And I think it's just what a cool concept that when someone opens a wine, they know exactly where it came from, and their hands, their own sweat equity is in that wine they're drinking. It's such a cool concept.
Yeah. And it's very unique. And one of the cool things, especially over a couple of years, I mean, now our members have their own personal blends of a Brunello that they made with Giacomo Neri. They're going to be in a couple of weeks. We'll be making their own champagne with Michel Drapier. This is the only champagne in the world with this exact precise blend, and they'll have 25 cases of it for themselves. They'll also go and do that with Riesling and with Ernie. So over time, our members end up with wines from all over the world and a deep understanding of each of these regions and an experience of what they are, who the people are, what the region's like, what the culture's like, and that. Kind of all together, I think, is really the big driver for our members.
Yeah, because you just enjoy it more. You enjoy wine more if you were there, because it's all about story and context. And it's one thing for a somm to be at a restaurant to tell you about this husband and wife team that became farmers and they made this wine and they have really narrow rows and they believe in high density and all this. It's another thing if you were there, you know, feeling that wind and that temperature and you in the middle of it all.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's the context. It's who you're with. It's how you're feeling. It's all of those things put together, and also knowing the story and knowing the people that are behind it.
So, Michael, where can people if they want to join up, they want to find out more about the vines, or they want to come in and visit you in Mendoza? What's the best way for people to get a hold of you?
Well, our website's easiest, and that's the-vines.com, the-vines.com is a great way to see about what we're doing. And also, for any of your listeners that might be interested, we have a couple spots on our upcoming trips to Montalcino, Champagne, Priorat, and Mosel in September and October. So feel free to reach out if anybody might like to join on that and get a little preview of what being a Vines member and a winemaker is like.
That would be, yeah. Anyone listening, if you're into wine and you've got the time and the access and the money for it, I mean, my God, and just all those places are iconic areas to try wine and areas like you might not think about, like Priorat, someplace you don't normally think of in Spain, because you usually think of Rioja, Ribera del Douro. It's some of the best Spanish wines in the world come from that region.
That's the deal. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the discussion. If you need anything else, let me know. Do let me know if you come down to Argentina. We'd love to have you to be our guest for a couple of days at the Vines and keep exploring.
Absolutely. And again, what a cool concept you came up with. Congratulations on all the success, turning this passion into a realistic project and helping more people learn about all these cool little nooks and crannies of the wine world. All the best, Michael. Thank you for being a part of the podcast.
Appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Matt. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.